Philip Carlo. He is a master profile of serial killers and kidnappers and pedophiles. He literally wrote the book on one serial killer by the name of Richard Ramirez, a.k.a. the Night Stalker, several years ago. He regularly lectures around the world for police departments on profiling and looking into mass murderers and pedophiles and kidnappers. Now he has a brand new book just hitting the stores today called Predators and Prayers, a story about murder and pedophilia in the Catholic Church. And I'm happy to welcome him to the Paul Harris Show today. Philip, welcome.
Hey, Paul, thank you.
My pleasure having you on today. When you do a novel about the Catholic Church, you open yourself up for a lot of pressure, I'm guessing.
It's an astute observation, yeah. I have been kind of attacked here, there, and everywhere, but I expected that, and it's something actually I'm welcoming. You know, this is a novel, but it's a novel based on about 12 years of research. I opted to write it as a novel because there was no one or series of stories that clearly delineated all the truths involved in this heinous business of the Catholic Church filling with pedophiles. You know, the situation here is not good priest gone bad because they were celibate or some nonsense like that. What we have going on here is pedophiles knowing they would get aided, protected, and joining the church for that reason. It all began in the 50s and 60s, which I found out during my research, and no one seems to realize the simple equation that child molesters always seek out employment where they come into contact with children. We know that for a fact. It's been proven time and time again. Boy Scout leaders, school bus drivers, people that work in the cafeterias of school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, big brothers. The pedophile community, which is a close-knit society, although they are very close, realized this in the late 50s and 60s and began joining the church in mass, knowing that the church would they'd have free access to trusting children and that they'd have the respectability of the church wrapped around them. I don't say this lightly. I say this only because I went out in the world and I talked to many people and I read between the lines and I listened to not only what was said to me but the truth. I have been involved in this issue of child sexual abuse for many years. I wrote a book in 1980 that came out in 86 called Stolen Flower, which was about abducted children who were using child pornography around the world. The story takes place in New York and all over Europe. And as a result of that book, I became deeply immersed in these issues. I never meant to. I was not necessarily a social do-gooder as such. I just saw a really important story that seemed very dramatic that needed to be told, and I told it. And suddenly I was doing all these news shows and Larry King and Donahue and meeting more and more people, meeting more and more victims, started lecturing police departments around the world, Scotland Yard, Interpol, the NYPD here, and speaking at symposiums on this issue, child sexual abuse, literally around the world. I met more and more people, more and more victims. So I had a wide base of information by the time I started writing about this particular problem with pedophiles entering the church. I wrote a play about the problem called Swear on God You Won't Tell in 1993, which was done here in New York, and I entitled it that because I kept hearing how molesters dressed as priests. I really can't even call them priests at this juncture. Forgive me, Paul, but that's what they are, basically, molesters guised as priests. And I named it that because victims were telling me that these individuals were saying to them, swear on God you won't tell what I'm doing, swear on God you won't tell, you'll go to hell, threatening them with the specter of God. Often the abuse actually happened in churches, in the back of altars, in confessionals even. We know this came out during testimony during the Boston scandals. I got involved with the Night Stalker book. I wrote that, and then I came back to this, and I went to Europe in, I think, 2001 or so, and I wrote this book while living in Rome, very near the Vatican, actually, and I had a feeling it would be a good place to write this story, and it really was, because the more I saw the omnipotent power of the Vatican and how priests and cardinals walk around Rome as though they are aristocracy. It just made me see the real truth behind what was happening, who was manipulating this, how it was allowed to go on. I have to emphasize to your listeners that I have nothing against the Catholic Church. I was born a Catholic. I was baptized. I went to catechism. It's their aiding and abetting of child rapists on a huge scale that incensed me and drove me to write this book.
I get the same thing, by the way, because, you know, with St. Louis having a large Catholic population and the Archdiocese here being embroiled in part of the pedophile priest scandal, naturally it became a topic for my show many, many days over the last several years.
And
lots of people would call up and say, well, it's obvious that you just hate the Catholic Church. And I would say, I'm not saying anything of the kind. I'm saying there are bad people in many different organizations, and that doesn't mean that the Catholic Church is bad, that there are bad people within it, but the problem is that you had people in the hierarchy of the church who were covering up child abuse. I mean, that's the bottom line here. People who are having sex with children. We would not permit that were it to be going on at Starbucks. Why would we say it's okay in the church for the hierarchy there to cover it up? And that's what you've written about, right?
Absolutely. It is all about that. It's almost like it's like a spider on a mirror. You don't know what's the spider, the reflection or the spider. What we're seeing essentially is, if I may, in the 1950s, this is what I learned through years of research. I'm the type of writer that goes out in the world. I don't read newspaper accounts. I don't sit at my desk trying to get people on the phone. I go all over the place and I find out the truth. This is the truth. In the 1950s and the 1960s, pedophiles realized that they can join the church in mass and have what they wanted, plus get food and clothing and shelter, and like I said, the respectability of the church, and most importantly, access to trusting children. They chose the church because they knew they'd have access to children, and the church basically looked the other way, constantly and consistently. John Gagan was the priest who was beaten to death in a Boston jail last year. I'm sure your listeners know who this individual was.
This is the guy who was shuttled around to, I believe, 93 different parishes.
Well, actually, it was that many parishes. As difficult as that is to believe, here's an individual that's sexually raping children, prepubescent children, by the way, we're talking about, listeners. We're not talking about teenagers. We're talking about prepubescent. That's what pedophiles seek. That's what they're asking. He abused children in every single parish he was put in. Their answer consistently and across the board was move them to another parish. They moved them from one end of the country to the other end, back and forth, east coast to the west coast, then up north and then up south. And then finally, when he was in his early 70s, he was arrested and he was adjudicated and he was found guilty. But all during his trial, he was arrogant. He was supercilious. He was condescending. He was a very, very typical molester. He happened to be caught with his hand in a cookie jar. They gave him 12 years. He wasn't in jail 2 months and another prisoner beat him to death. I'm told that most every bone in his body was broken. And you want to know something, Paul? Somehow I don't feel bad about that. I feel that guy got his just desserts. I feel society did not know how to deal with him, did not deal with him correctly, and he got what he deserved. If you're willing to rape children on a regular basis and hide behind the mask of a priest and wear that collar and wear a crucifix on your neck, you deserve to get beaten to death as far as I'm concerned.
Do you think, Philip, that people above him in the church who were covering it up should also have been held more criminally responsible than they were?
Absolutely. Great question, Paul. And the truth of the matter is the cardinal that was the most responsible for this individual being moved around like that, this child rapist dressed as a priest, was Cardinal, and I say that sarcastically, Bernard Law. Bernard Law was the single biggest individual that caused more abuse than any one cardinal, except maybe Mahoney in Los Angeles County. This guy moved over 60 priests that we know of, that the church acknowledges, to different parishes, never had one of them arrested. His answer was always to send lawyers who were priests to the parents of the abused. They would make a deal. They'd give the money under the table. They would be assured that the wayward priest would be get guidance and be put in a program. And the only guidance that wayward priest ever got was to be put in another parish where they immediately went about abusing children. This cretin, this guy that was beaten to death, at a point in time was put in a hospital, a Catholic hospital, and he was actually abusing little boys who were cancer victims. This is what we're talking about here. Now, by the way, this individual graduated St. John's Seminary in 1960. Another noted molester dressed as a priest was Paul Shanley. Paul Shanley, like Gagin, had been moved to numerous parishes all over the country over a 35-year period, abused children in every parish. In February, he was found guilty finally and sent away. He's sitting in jail now wondering when he's going to get attacked. Then, you know, it's interesting. In prisons where you have basically the worst elements of society, even those individuals will not tolerate a child rapist. These guys have to be kept in protective custodies. They cannot be put in population. If they are put in population, their days are quite literally numbered. And that's very telling. I mean, any civilized society that allows the raping of children is not a civilized society at all. And somehow, the church managed to kind of sail through this scandal pretty unscathed. And interestingly, Paul Shanley also graduated St. John's in 1960. This is a statistical fact. Also, by the way, interestingly, Bernard Law graduated St. John's in 1956. And also scores of other people who were ultimately arrested or banned or chased out of different parishes by outraged parishioners. By the way, this is happening across the country.
Yep.
Not in any one particular city. It's across the board in every major city in the United States. And Bernard Law also came out of St. John's. Now, what that tells us is that, well, forgive me, I lost my thought a moment, but not only these three individuals, but scores of other predator priests came out of St. John's. And also, it's worth noting that many of the individuals that are ultimately arrested are in the 70s and in the late 60s. So if you just look at the simple mathematics, they graduated the seminaries in the 60s, the late 50s, and in the mid-60s, and that's why you have all these old men being arrested for child rape. Most of them got away with it, though, because of the 7-year statute of limitations on sex crimes. This is an outrage. This is something that needs to be changed. When you murder somebody, you can be tried 20, 30, 40 years later. There is no statute of limitations. For rape, there's a statute of 7 years, which is absolutely outrageous. That means if you rape a child and 7 years and one day goes by, you can walk scot-free. Nobody can say a word from you, and that's exactly what the bulk of the molesters did and got away with. Why? Because the children that were abused were so frightened and so unbelieved and disbelieved by their parents that they were able to skirt around this, get around this. And when the molestation grew to such humongous proportions that they couldn't hide it anymore, finally victims started coming out. And busloads, trainloads of victims started coming forth and saying, he did this to me, he did that to me, he did this to me, he told me that, he scared me here. And, you know, child rape unto itself is probably one of the most dastardly crimes that I can think of. But when it's done by a person imitating a messenger of God, a spiritual advisor, somebody that must be called father, that must be given the respect of that title, you're told you must call him father. And these are not fathers. These are wolves in sheep's clothing. And, you know, I can't help when I talk about this to not start getting angry. I was not abused by a priest. I have no axe to grind against anyone. It's just that when you think about the long-lasting damage they did to hundreds of thousands of children over a 50-year period, it's an absolute outrage. And, you know, it's what amazes me is when I see these victims talk on television about what, or news shows about what was done, they still refer to them as priests. They still call them cardinal and bishop, and they speak with them with respect. And I don't get it. You know, it seems to me what should be happening to these individuals is exactly what happened to John Gagan. Put him in jails and let nature take its course.
All right, Philip, I got to take a break here. We'll come back and talk more about this, plus some of the other things that you've done in your writing past and your criminal profiling past, et cetera. Philip Carlo's new book is called Predators and Prayers. It is in bookstores today. This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Philip Carlo has been writing about child abuse cases and kidnapping and serial killers for more than two decades now. His new book is a novel called Predators and Prayers, about the murder of a Catholic priest who's in the midst of the world of pedophilia, and has gotten all emotional about it in talking about it. And I can hear in your voice the intensity of this issue. And you mentioned as we were finishing up the last segment that there should no longer be a statute of limitations on any of these things. That is one of the things that held back prosecutors from going after some of these pedophile priests, because kids who had been molested at 7, 8, 12 years old, by the time they got to be adults, it was too late for anybody to look back and go after them, right?
Exactly. And this is a crying shame. Rape is really a terrible, terrible crime. And just because a couple of days goes by one way or another, they should not be allowed to walk away from it. If there was a public referendum about this, I guarantee you the public would overwhelmingly want the law changed. And the law should be changed. And it could be changed, actually. Your listeners, everybody I've been talking to, I've been saying this to, write your congressmen, write your senators, put fire under them, make them do what needs to be done. This is an absolute outrageous situation. It's specifically now we're talking about pedophiles in the church, but just rapists in general. The sex crime should not be allowed to disappear after 7 years. It's a crying shame. You know, Megan's Law, which mandate was passed after a child named Megan was murdered, and she was a 10-year-old girl murdered by a molester who was in the neighborhood and no one knew about it. So Megan's Law mandates that when molesters are in any given neighborhood, people in the neighborhood have the right to know. That happened as a direct result of the parents and the public demanding change, demanding laws, and it happened. The Amber Alert, which is another law that was recently passed because the public was up in arms. The Amber Alert mandates that if a child is taken, it's the law that on all the traffic postings that car, a hypothetically 1998 Chevy, is an abducted child in that car, license plate number, and it's passed from one police jurisdiction to another, to the other, to the other, and it's helped get back hundreds of children. But again, it did not happen until the public demanded it. The public needs to demand no statute of limitations for sex crimes. It's a crime that is heinous, perhaps even worse than rape, because the people who suffer the abuse. It's lasting. Many of the individuals that I spoke to that had been abused by priests have problems, serious problems, deep psychological problems. They're confused about their sexuality, spirituality. They get involved with drug abuse, alcohol abuse. They have problems in the bedrooms with their spouses, all as a direct result of them being raped by somebody who was supposed to be a representative of God. Can there be anything more heinous? Is there anything more heinous?
Philip, as you were looking into this over the last 13 years, doing research on this and related topics and eventually writing this book about it, did you talk to people who were not themselves involved but were just parishioners who were upset that the money that they had put into the donation plate year after year after year in their local parish had gone to pay off the victims of what these horrible crimes had been through the years?
Right.
Because we're talking about tens of million dollars in payoffs. And in fact, some archdioceses have actually had to sell off some of their property and some of their churches to make some of these payments.
I did, in fact. And they, by the way, they're the people that forced Bernard Law to be taken out of Boston. It was the parishioners that finally were so up in arms. Thousands of them were picketing his home. And the Vatican saw it as a publicity nightmare. So their answer was to take Law out of Boston, bring him to Rome, and put him in charge of the Catholic Church inside Vatican City.
Mm.
Give me a break. Not only that, they allowed this individual to say Mass for the Pope when he died recently. And there were several thousand victims who flew on at their own cost to Rome and were there picketing at the Vatican that day. It was raining, but they were still out there, and they were kept made to stay in this little squared-off area, and there were people with machine guns guarding them. And all of them were just the victims of rapists dressed as priests, but they were treated like they were the bad ones, not anyone else. The money, Boston alone, which is where Bernard Law was the cardinal, spent $87 million on paying off victims. More recently, I should say, in Orange County, they paid $105 million to victims of abuse by predator priests. To date, the Catholic Church has paid over $1 billion out to the victims of predator priests.
Now, when you talked to the victims, did they want money to make things right?
Well, you know, because of the statute of limitations had passed, that's the only kind of justice they were able to get.
Mm.
And often the money was needed and mandated because these people were crippled emotionally, spiritually, and in some instances physically. I know of three instances where people were committed suicide as a result of a direct result of what happened to them. And then trying to tell your parents or your guardians and not be believed, which made them even feel worse. And yes, to answer your question, the parishioners are absolutely outraged, and a lot of them have, in fact, stopped giving money. And that's the only answer. And by the way, you know, it's interesting. I kind of liken it to what Michael Jackson did. I know Michael Jackson was found innocent, but I believe Michael Jackson walked the walk, talked the talk. If it walks, talks, and acts like a duck, it usually is a duck. And he paid off two individuals. He gave them over $20 million. In other words, it was just about hushing up this scandal. Let's stop the scandal. That's all they ever cared about. That's all they still care about. It was the Vatican. It was people that graduated seminaries in the 50s and 60s who became cardinals, who became bishops, who aided and embedded their contemporaries. Because I believe Bernard Law is a pedophile. I believe there's no way in hell that any man, a responsible, mature man, would allow a child molester to continue molesting and not even report them to the police. They never reported one molester over all those years, and they still didn't until a loaded gun was put to their head, and they finally started giving me the names of priests who had numerous reports against them.
The book is called Predators and Prayers. It is just hitting bookstores today on the first day of publication. Philip Carlo, my guest here on the Paul Harris Show. You can find a link to the book, of course, on my website, harrisonline.com. We'll come back with more in just a moment on the 50,000-watt blowtorch News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Philip Carlo, his new book is called Predators and Prayers. 7 or 8 years ago, he had a major bestseller with a book called The Night Stalker, The Life and Crimes of Richard Ramirez. Let's talk about that for just a moment here, Philip, because you actually sat down and spent, I don't know, 100 hours or so in jail face-to-face with this guy. What is that like, getting into a jail and looking into the eyes of a serial killer?
Well, you know, Paul, thank you for asking that question. That is part and parcel of what I've been describing, my going out, and no matter where I have to go, to find the truth. Richard, when I did my interviews with him, he was actually in San Quentin's death row. So it wasn't a jail. It's like much worse than a jail. The ambiance there is pure death. All the inmates there are going to die, and it's a very, very dangerous place. These guys more or less have nothing to lose, and so there's a lot of tension in the air. There's like the violence, the potential for violence. You can almost touch it and feel it. I was alone because of my lecturing at the New York Police Department's Academy. They wrote a letter on my behalf to the warden of San Quentin, and they gave me unprecedented access to Richard. And I was able to sit alone with him in a room for weeks on end, from 8 to 2 every day. And what's it like? I mean, you know, serial killers all have a duality about them. The Richard that I interacted with for the most part was the nice Richard. They all have another side. I mean, if you look at Ted Bundy, everyone was so shocked that he could be a serial killer. Everyone thought he was so nice.
Yeah, they always say that when a serial killer is found. All of his neighbors say he was such a nice, quiet man.
Right. John Wayne Gacy was a clown. He entertained children on weekends. Jeffrey Dahmer worked in a fancy chocolate store, and everyone thought he was the nicest guy in the world. And so that's one of the reasons why they're so successful. More or less, also, look at the BTK killer. He was the pillar of the community.
Yep.
He was the deacon of the church. Everyone thought he was a great guy. Everyone was shocked. They're still shocked that he turned out to be a torturer, a murderer, and an extreme sexual sadism.
And actually, because of that nice guy image, these guys actually get love letters from women and marriage proposals in jail, don't they?
I was at the wedding. When Richard ultimately got married in death row, he invited me to go, and it's something I wanted to see. And I went, and he got married in a room where all the visitors, mind you, everyone there has a death sentence on their head, and many of the people have killed numerous individuals. A lot of serial killers are on San Quentin's death row. For some reason, California has an enormous amount of serial killers. And if I may, I'll quickly tell the story. The ceremony happened, began over a quiet corner of this room, about 100 by 100 feet, and the room was filled with killers who were having their visits. When the ceremony began, everyone became respectfully quiet, and the pastor there made the ceremony. And the quiet kind of startled me, and I turned around, and I saw everyone was sitting respectfully quiet as the Ramirez got married. And I couldn't believe how, you know, there was the 1-5 killer, there's the freeway killer, there's the Mount Tamales killer, all sitting there respectfully quiet so the Night Stalker could get married. I mean, it's like surreal.
Unbelievable.
So the pastor did not say until death do you part at the end. And I asked him, I said, you know, why didn't you say until death do you part? And he said to me, you don't say that on death row, it's bad form.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to have these killers be insulted by a word. And it's funny to me, they have no reverence for human life, but they've got reverence for the marriage ceremony of some sick woman who is marrying some serial killer, and it's unbelievable. Well, I think you've got another hit book on your hands here. I read The Night Stalker in 1997. It actually gave me nightmares,
right.
I will tell you that. And this one, I think, is going to shake people up as well.
I hope so.
It's called Predators and Prayers. This one's a novel, but it does dig deep inside what has been a huge cover-up of child abuse and pedophilia in the Catholic Church over more than just the last few years that we've been hearing about it, but actually going on for decades. Thank you for your time today, Phil.
Well, thank you. You're a great host, and I really appreciate you giving time for me to voice this.
Thanks. I hope we can do it again.
Excellent.
Philip Carlo, the book Predators and Prayers, here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.